78, we're banging them out. We're at a torrid pace right now. We're doing like three a week now. We have a very distinguished guest with us today. I'm going to get to him in a second. We have Pat and Jimmy, regulars. The Dalpiaz family is here.
Yep. Good morning. Hi, everyone.
Ron Gilson is with us.
Good morning.
We're going to talk about some Gloucester history, including old diners and Cameron's, seeing as Cameron's has just been demolished. Ron is going to give us a little of that. My name is Joey Shimataro, your host, and it is January 24th. Only seven more days, another week, and we'll be ticking off to February. I'm not going to say that we're almost in the clear as far as weather.
Oh, no, you cannot.
Cannot. Not after, like, 3 or 4 years ago, we had no weather all the way through January. And I remember saying it at the end of January, well, we're almost in the clear. And then we got absolutely annihilated. So we're not going to say we're almost in the clear. But it's been good so far. We'll take it.
It's been a not so much wet January, according to the thing.
Yeah. Are you recording, Jim?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
I am recording.
Pull yourself right over, Jim.
Yes.
Get right in there. If you can get even tighter, that'd be awesome, Jimmy.
Okay.
All right. So we're going to go, we're going to slide into our guest cam right here, and we're going to bring our friend Ron Gilson in. So, Ron.
Yes.
Cameron's is gone.
Yes.
What did Cameron's, what are your remembering?
My remembrance of Cameron's dates back to the 40s. Dates back to the 40s, and that's an interesting story. Cameron's is on the corner of Elm Street and Main Street. And in those days, my days, there was a series of old buildings there, a two-and-a-half-story frame building on the corner, apartments above, and the commercial business below was Karam's Army and Navy Store. Next to the Army and Navy Store, Cameron's Cafe. Now, I have pleasant memories of Cameron's Cafe because any resemblance between that and the building that they're tearing down as we speak, there's no resemblance.
Oh, really?
Cameron's of my day was a one-story extension, if you will, of the building that was next to it. So as you look at Cameron's, Karam's Army and Navy would be to the left on the corner of Elm Street, and the small Cameron's barroom, nightclub or whatever, it wasn't a nightclub, but a fisherman's bar was, as a boy, I walked by there from coming from the Strand Theater on the West End, it was always a quaint place. It was the windows were probably waist high, and they were all small pane windows. It was a quaint little place, a very, very homey, and it was a fisherman's bar. It was also owned by Captain Frank Brown, a highline fisherman who had a brand new vessel built in 1944 at Robinson Shipyard. A little diversion here, but Frank was a
skipper.
Where
was Robinson Shipyard?
Robinson Shipyard was William A. Robinson Shipyard was in Ipswich, Mass., located on the Crane Estate because Robinson married the Crane girl, Florence Crane, and his father-in-law gave him a piece of the Crane Estate. They dug this creek out. It was called Fox Creek. And they created Robinson Shipyard, which manufactured vessels for the war effort. Now, the Crane Estate, of course, as you know, is the plumbing magnet. So there was a lot of money there, and they created this modern shipyard. And Crane's son-in-law, William A. Robinson, used that property as a major shipbuilding port in the era. That all ended in 1944 when Bill Robinson divorced his wife and his father-in-law threw him out. That's another story. anyway, the Emily Brown, Captain Frank Brown's new vessel was built in 1944, at the Robinson Shipyard, and Gloucester was a different place. It was a boom town, and Frank Brown owned and operated Cameron's Cafe. As I remember it, as I said, it was a quaint little place.
What years are we talking about?
We're talking about 1944, when the Emily Brown was built, but I'm sure Cameron's was in existence in that same configuration early in the 1940s. I was a boy going to the movie theaters and so forth, and I was always fascinated by the quaintness. It's just a lovely little bar room, and as I say, the fishermen congregated there, and Captain Frank Brown was of Portuguese descent, and safe to say there were a lot of Portuguese fishermen that frequented the bars, fishing skippers.
You speak of the theaters in town. There's the Strand, and what was the other one?
The Strand is was on the west end, of course, directly across from Bananas. That's a parking lot now for the Brass Monkey. And because the land slopes off, you walked in on the street level and you went downstairs to get to the main seating area.
Yeah, right.
And all you walked right into the balcony. But anyway, that was the Strand on the west end. On the east end was the North Shore Theater, and that's in the exact location as Campbell's Package Store today. That's where the North Shore Theater was. Anyway, getting back to Cameron's, it was not a nightclub. It was a fisherman's bar, but it was as I had pleasant memories. And as only a kid, I don't know why, but it was just a nice. It was just a nice establishment at the time. And from there, we came along years later and created the building that we're tearing down today, as I speak. In fact, I was just there and watched the rubble being hauled off and so forth. So, anyway.
I want to just chime in. Brenda Grimes Davis says Ron Gilson is one of my favorite people with a big heart.
Brenda?
Brenda Grimes.
God love her. She's a good person. Yeah. Lives on Perkins Street, up on the hill somewhere.
Yeah.
Green Street or someplace. She's a nice person.
Yeah. So tell me, so when did the changes happen at Cameron's to get it where it was before we...
You know. Well, I'm a little foggy on that. I know Cameron's was in existence a long time before the present building was erected. And when it happened, the whole area from Elm Street down, the big 2.5-story Karam's Army and Navy that's on Main Street today, operated by Karam's relatives, his daughters and nieces.
It's not open anymore, though.
Well... It was there.
It
was by North Shore Furniture Company or the Empire Clothing Store.
Right, right. I think it's where Divas, right on the, what's that street that goes down to the waterfront?
A
little jewelry
right
store.
On the corner. Of
right
that
on the corner,
street.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
That
actually, I think it's where Barbara Keown's place is, the thrift shop there.
Yeah, no, it's a consignment store.
Dress code. Yeah. Right, the dress code.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
right. That was because I remember going
right
there back in the early.
Stevenson, the artist, lived next door.
Right.
As you ran down over the hill to Roger Street. Yeah. But anyway, so that link is that girl or lady was probably the daughter of Karam. That there were two brothers. By
so
the
wait
way,
wait a second. In between the modern Camerons and the old Cameron's, there was that Irish place. They were selling roast beef sandwiches. Oh, what was the name of it? Brenda Davis would know this. There was for a brief period of time, someone else had it in the early 80s, I want to say, and was it not Kelly's? Brenda, help me out here. Oh, God.
I don't remember.
Brenda Davis, if you're still watching, what was Cameron's in the early 80s? It was an Irish guy owned it, and they served roast beef sandwiches.
Oh, wait a minute. The Irish guy that owned it was Charlie Tiernan. Charlie Tiernan.
Right, from Charlie's Liquors.
Who owns Charlie's Liquor Locker and so forth.
Right.
But Charlie Tiernan, I believe, was operating Cameron's at the time, because at the schooner races, this hooks into the schooner races, and Sherman Schwicker, who was the mayor of Lunenburg, and his wife Barbara would dine at Cameron's, but they dined as the guests of Charlie Tiernan. So he was the owner of. And then after that, I think Earl Foote took over and so forth. That's when the Union Hill Coffee House was in business. Right. That's in the 80s. We opened it in 81.
I can't think of the name of that place. It was an Irish kind of an old, and they had big St. Patrick's Day parties.
Yes,
there.
That's right. Yes.
Huge.
And also post election parties down there, gatherings. Gus Foote would gas off down there and so forth. Yeah, yeah.
That's funny. Do you know anything about the making of the big, iconic Cameron sign?
Cameron's,
you know that.
Well, I have a memory
Jeff
of that.
The LeJean family took it over after and had run it for a while.
I have a memory of that, but I can't remember.
E. Ray Kelly.
Kelly's.
God damn it.
That's
the Young.
Esther
Young gets the.
You got there.
Yes.
Atta girl.
Yes.
You can't get much more Irish of a name than Kelly.
Mm.
E. Ray Kelly. E. Ray's. Yeah. I remember because we used to go there. We used to. Yeah. So as my youth, as a middle schooler, we used to. My mom would drop in my grade, like eighth graders. We would go to the YMCA. We would hang out at the YMCA all day for days. We would play basketball. We would hang around. It was the place where a lot of kids had their first girlfriends and stuff like that. And you would walk down, and then there was Beef and Bun roast beef, or there was E. Ray Kelly's, and you would go get a roast beef sandwich. Your mom would send you down. You know, send you with like $3 or $4.
Bob Parks's Beef and Bun.
Yeah, ballpark. Yeah, yeah. Great spot, too.
Yeah.
They did it. They probably did it as good as anybody did.
Yeah.
Their roast beef sandwiches were fantastic.
Yeah, they did good. The sauce was great.
The sauce. Yeah, you know what? They used James River back then. They still use the same James River barbecue sauce today with most of the roast beef places.
Yeah. I didn't realize roast beef was such a specialty type of sandwich up here. I didn't realize that.
Oh,
Julie's wondering if we know anything about where the sign went.
Yeah, we asked. No, we don't know.
There is a history to that sign, but I can't.
Yeah.
Maybe somebody can chime in with that. Yeah. That would be great if someone can chime in with that. That's fantastic knowledge. Yeah. So now they tore it down, and it's going to be retail on the first floor. And
apartments.
Low-income
apartments.
Yeah, I don't want to misspeak it, because there's a difference between affordable housing and low-income housing. Mm-hmm. And I don't know which one it is, and I don't want to misspeak to that.
A little unclear on that myself.
We're gonna call it housing till we get more information. Mm-hmm.
It's housing, but I like the idea of retail on the on the first floor.
And Donna Artizoni says hello to Ron.
Well, that's not what she said.
You may repeat it. I'm not gonna repeat that.
She said hello, hello, sweet cheeks. Is
yes.
what she said.
Yeah.
Whatever. Told you, work right at me.
What is that? I have to go take care of a boat for just a few minutes, but I'd like you to speak to Tommy Burns' Celebration of Life, which I know you went to last night.
Yes.
You can speak right here, Ron.
Okay.
All right.
This is where we get to talk about Joe.
Oh, goodness. I'm going to put this here. We're rolling right now, so you can go right ahead, Ron.
Tommy Burns' Celebration of Life I attended last night at the Emerson Inn in Rockport. And just as a side, I was interested in the venue, because in 1994, I was the maitre d' at the Emerson Inn. So I was interested in the renovations and so forth under the new ownership. And it really is a pretty place, and it's an ideal place to have a commemorative service, if you will, or a celebration of my friend Tommy Burns' life. It was well attended. I'd say there were probably a couple hundred people there. And I met a lot of old friends from the waterfront, and of course a lot of Tommy's friends here at Captain Joe's Lobster Wharf in East Gloucester. And it was just well done. The hors d'oeuvres and the finger foods and the food in general was excellent. And it was just a family thing. Tommy had a big family and a lot of well wishes, and they were there, and it was just a nice thing to do.
Do you have one story that you remember, Tommy?
Yeah, Tommy.
I've been hearing many stories down here, Tommy, from all the fishermen.
There's many stories about Tommy, but you see, Tommy was known around the waterfront as a master mechanic. He was he had a lot of mechanical ability. He could, if you'll pardon the expression, he could put an ass in the cat. He was a smart man and a mechanical aptitude. And that's one side of Tommy. But he also had a historical side. And it's that historical side I'd like to speak to, because when he found out that I knew a few things about the waterfront historically, why, he would test me, if you will. And he'd ask me some questions to see if I was an authentic guy. Well, it happens that I was a few years older, and I arrived on the scene a few years before him. And I've always said that if you're 75 years of age or under, you missed the whole show. So if you're not 85, you missed the whole show in the city of Gloucester in the 4th century. Well, Tommy was a little bit younger, but he was a student of the waterfront, and as I say, historically inclined, and he would ask me questions. So at one time, you asked about a story. I said to Tommy, in quizzing him, I said, Tom, you know, there was a big shipyard in Ipswich in the 40s that, you remember that? And he says, yeah, I think I do. Wasn't that Robinson Shipyard? I said, yes, it was Robinson's, William A. Robinson Shipyard. And in the year 1944, at the coming on the end of World War II, the pipeline for government ships had ended, Robinson, looking for business, and the fishing fleet in need of new blood, if you will, new vessels. Robinson, in 1 year, 1944, built 12 commercial fishing vessels for Gloucester.
What type of boats were they?
They were all draggers, with the exception of one, which was an oil tanker. That oil tanker is named Captain Dave, and it's still in existence today. Still around the waterfront, owned by the Rose family. But anyway, I said to Tommy, I says, now, that all started in 1939, Robinson, and there was a vessel built in 1939, the first commercial dragger out of the Robinson shipyard. And now, Tommy, what was the name of that vessel? Well, I don't know. You don't know? Well, I'm going to tell you. The name of the vessel was Our Lady of Good Voyage, and the owner, captain, was Manuel Rocha. Well, he sat back. He says, I'll have to go through my things and check that out. A couple of days later, on a Sunday morning, he came into McDonald's restaurant, which we gather there on Sunday mornings, and he had an envelope for me. He says, Ron, I have a present for you. And I opened the envelope, and there was an 8x10 glossy photo of the schooner, Our Lady of Good Voyage, a schooner dragger, Captain Manuel Rocha, steaming down the North Channel. In the background is the brand new state fish pier that was dedicated in 1938. And I know the building was new at the time, because it wasn't an ice chute coming out of the building. So that photo was placed about 1940. And of course, the Lady Good Voyage was launched in 1939. So it's it's an original configuration of the Lady Good Voyage, which changed drastically after that. So I know it was an early picture. And Tommy Burns had that in his memorabilia at home.
His son said after he passed that he had a big huge kitchen table, and it was just stacks and stacks of books from the 1920s of yeah. old, of books yeah. about scores.
Oh, yeah,
and,
yeah. And so he had, Tommy had a historical bent, and he was very knowledgeable, I will say that. But again, he was about 7 or 8 years younger than me, and he missed the whole show. He did a good job, even though he missed a lot of it. That's my story on Tommy.
That's a great story. Thank you for that. There's a lot, there's, you know, these old timers, they got so, and just, you know, the thing that's crazy to me is that Ron, I can't remember from year to year what, and it, other than what the year that I graduated from high school, the year that I graduated from college, I could, they all, the years all float together to me. I couldn't tell you a thing that he can go exact
you
years.
You do have an extraordinary memory.
Yeah, he's gifted that way. He is gifted that way.
You better get me fast.
Yeah. Cameron's is gone.
Yes.
The Santander Bank is going where Orange Leaf yeah. was located in Mac Bell's. Can you give me a little background on that parking lot and that where A&P grocery store was? Was that part of the harbor that was filled in?
No.
It was further down, closer no. to, is it closer to where the Strand Theater was? Not the Strand,
no,
the...
No. Where the Rose Baker's Senior Citizens Center.
That was,
place.
That was...
That was Vincent Cove, and it was all filled in. But in my day, the North Shore Theater, which is Campbell's Package Store today, the North Shore Theater was there.
And Liquor Locker.
And if you had an aerial photograph of that area, you would look down on that big theater building and a big parking lot in back, right. Municipal parking lot, and that was Vincent Cove. Back in the 1900s, that was a body of water, and there was a shipyard, several shipyards there, and that it was all filled in. But as a, you know, it's an interesting story. It's a we want to talk about the Hesperus Diner, and I want to get there. But to talk about the Hesperus Diner, you have to talk. To me, it's that's just one part of the puzzle, if you will, the mosaic. If you're talking about the Hesperus Diner, you have to know the whole area there, and you have to know the times we lived in, because you see, at the risk of sounding like an old man, and I am, I guess, and what we have today, Gloucester, is a shadow of what we were then. The diners that we had then, whether it's a Cape Ann Grill down the fort, or the Michelle's Cape Ann Diner, or the Hesperus Diner, or Lufkin's Diner, they cannot exist today because we don't have the clientele of customers for them. When they flourished, the Hesperus Diner in the 1940s, my word, it was the most popular.
Hello, which one was the Hesperus Diner?
What's that?
Which one was the Hesperus Diner?
See that?
No, look, so I can bring it up on the screen.
Now, the Hesperus Diner was on the corner of Elm Street.
On which one? Which
I mean,
one?
Chestnut Street.
So that's the one where the Supreme's is now?
Roast Beef Place is today.
Okay. So I'm going to bring that in so people can see what we're talking about. Okay.
Okay. The Hesperus, you have to understand how exciting it was. And I was a little boy, but I... You know, it was an era that'll never come back. And anyway, my boyhood friend and mentor was a guy by the name of Ben Pine. Ben Pine was the leader of the waterfront. There were three leaders of the waterfront: Manuel P. Domingos, which was the Portuguese United Fisheries at the far end of east end of Main Street, and then there was John J. Burke, who was in the middle by the Hesperus Diner. He owned the Hesperus Diner, by the way. And then there was Ben Pine at the corner of the Coast Guard station is today. And of course, in the fort, I said there were three, there were four. And the fort was Benjamin Kukuru, which is, you know, he was a household word and bankers and
my great grandfather.
Your grandfather, that's
great,
right.
Great-grandfather.
Yes, good guy, great guy.
Benny Kukuru.
you know, and his background is an unbelievable story. It all rides to Rich's background. But anyway, in the era, we had 4,000 people, the workforce in Gloucester, 4,000 people. And they were made up of wharf workers. They were all fishermen. There were over 200 vessels. So there was a couple thousand fishermen, and there were 2,000 or 3,000 wharf workers. A workforce in Gloucester of over 5,000 people.
Oh, hold on one second. I gotta bring the audio in. Why do we not have the audio all of a sudden? One second. I'll just transition here.
Are we all right?
Yeah, we're good. Okay. We're good. Tell James. Okay. Tell James, thank you. If you see that, let me know right away so I can correct it, Pat. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
So the era I'm talking about is 1945. In 1945, I was 12 years old, and I was totally captivated by the waterfront. While my classmates and peers and contemporaries were playing cops and robbers and baseball and hockey and so forth, I was on the waterfront 7 days a week, at least six, sometimes 7 days a week I would be on the waterfront. And I was attracted to the activity. It was an electric place. It was an exciting place. And there were 4,000 or 5,000 people in Gloucester that worked on that waterfront. Now, my mother, I was an only child. My grandfather lived with us, and he was retired from Stoddard Machine Shop, which was one of the leading machine shops on the waterfront in those days. There were six machine shops that we had in Gloucester. We now have one. There were six machine shops, and they all serviced the fishing fleet. Well, Grandpa lived with me, and he took me by the hand and introduced me to the waterfront and the fish pier in 1938 when it was dedicated. I was only 5 years old. From that, once I learned my way around, I could leave Grant behind, and I was on the waterfront as a boy. Up and down the waterfront, there was a boatyard, a shipyard on Parker Street, Monson's Boatyard, and I fell asleep in the Cigar Joe when she was being built as a kid. I played hooky from Camp Pinehurst. My mother discovered that I wasn't going to Camp Pinehurst. I was eating my lunch down the shipyard. She paid $7 a week for me to go to this camp, a summer camp, and she finally discovered that I was playing hooky, and the camp called, where was I? So she says, if I have to pay $7 a week for you to go to camp, and you're going down to Melanson's Boatyard and eating your lunch down there and coming home at the appointed time, 3 o'clock, that ended camp. Anyway, I was on the waterfront. It was an exciting place. And one of my mentors was a fellow by the name of Ben Pine. Ben Pine has a history like no other. The international fishermen's races, he owned vessels. He was a rags-to-riches guy. Started out as a junk man on the waterfront. Well, he befriended me. Now, my mother at the time, she had a dim view of the waterfront. My father was worked ashore. He was a bartender in many places, and that's another story. But she had a dim view of the waterfront and the people that populated the waterfront, and she thought that her son, was being exposed to kind of gritty people. She had a word for it. I won't use it here, but. Well, I'm here to report that she couldn't have been further from the truth. Because you see, the 4,000 or 5,000 people that were populated the waterfront and went fishing out of Gloucester were all fathers, mothers, breadwinners. They all had children home like me, but they were playing baseball. And I was the only kid on the waterfront, at least on the North Channel. And when they saw me down there, they befriended me. They were like my own parents. Ben Pine was one of those guys. Well, I was there on the Wharf all the time. Now, getting back to the Hesperus Diner, Ben Pines Wharf is where Captain Cowles is today. That's the wharf that the Ocean, well, it was a fish company, the Shewell's Fish Company, Star Fisheries. That was Ben Pines Wharf. And Ben Pine had 10 vessels that he managed, three of which he owned, four of which he owned outright. And it was an opening place, and it was a busy place. Ben Pine would start at 8:45 on a Saturday morning when I was there. And he started at the wharf. He had three carpenters working for him, Peter Shields, Austin Carter, and Caruco guy. The three carpenters worked there. He'd holler up, "Come on, let's go." And he'd grab me. If there was some Portuguese fishermen on the wharf with mark and wires, or whatever, come on. By the time we left that wharf down Water Street and got the machinists out of the Independent Machine Shop and the Gloucester Machine Shop and anybody else that was hanging around from the waterfront, the whole troop, maybe 15 or 20 people, would march up to the Hesperus Diner, would all fill the diner. Brud Doyle was on the grill. We'd all have a mug up, and nobody abused it. If you had breakfast that morning, you probably had a donut, but if you didn't have breakfast, you had ham and eggs, whatever you wanted, and Piney picked up the tab for the whole thing. He did that every day of the week for 6 days, Monday through Saturday. The Hesperus Diner, without question, was the most popular diner in town. There were several diners, and as I said, they couldn't exist in this day and age because the waterfront were the customers. The mug-ups, all of that business, it all was generated on the waterfront, and those diners were very popular. The diner on the fort down on Commercial Street.
The diner we had in East Gloucester that I went to when I was young was Sala's. In East Gloucester Square.
Yeah.
A 99-cent special. Two eggs, home fries, and toast for 99 cents.
Yeah, I know.
A solid special.
I know. Yeah. Well, anyway, the diner on
but this,
the fort.
But I would just like to say this, though. You say that, like, these diners couldn't exist, but we have this town, compared to any other town on the North Shore.
We're a breakfast town.
We're a breakfast town.
Yeah. Oh,
they
yes.
just may have morphed from diners
and
into other places.
And I'm living proof of that because our restaurant was the most popular. I hate to say
you started
it.
You started off the upscale breakfast thing.
Our restaurant was the most popular restaurant in town, and we had some great memories for 13 years. But getting back to the Hesperus Diner, at 10:30 at night when the North Shore Theater was out, we all piled right into the diner. At cheeseburgers and all. The diner was full of people. In the morning, all the lumpers gathered right there. The whole fleet, if you wanted to know what fishing boats were in town, you went to the Hesperus Diner at 5 o'clock in the morning. And there was a shape up, and there was all the lumpers all
gathered. The lumpers there, so the lumpers are there handing out the assignments, the boss lumpers.
Yeah.
Can you explain what a lumper is and what the hierarchy of a boss lumper and how they handed out the assignments?
Well, that's another interesting story.
Explain what a lumper is first.
All over the United States, we have lumpers. They're known by different names. Stevedores is one. Cargo handlers. As the story goes, we got lumpers. They do the same thing. They discharge cargo. But years ago on the sailing vessels, they were ballasted by pig irons. And there were lumps of iron that were placed in the vessel. When the vessel wasn't trimmed just right, lumpers, cargo, stevedores, would go aboard and literally move these heavy ingots of iron. They call them lumps, so they were lumpers. That's how that all came about.
Great story. I didn't
okay.
know that.
So.
But in the morning, were there several boss lumpers that would hand out the assignments? Yeah. How did these guys get the jobs?
Well, usually the senior people, Josie Patrickin and Bubsy Horn and, these were boss lumpers. They were the bosses, and they had crews that worked with them.
Now, did they have relationships with the wharfs, or did they have relationships with the captains of the boats?
No, they had relationships with the captains of the boat. Nothing to do with the wharf.
Yep.
A
lumper's responsibility was what?
What's that?
What was the lumper's responsibility?
A lumper's responsibility was to go aboard the vessel at 5 o'clock in the morning and rig the vessel. That is, lift the gaffs, get the vessel ready to take out fish. The basket's in place. And the lumpers would come down. They had their own, they brought their own equipment, a fish walk
shovel, pitchforks, mostly pitchforks.
Yeah, mostly fish walks and so forth. They all had lumpers cars. These were old junk cars that they drove down because they also took home some fish out of the trip. Right? But that's another story. Anyway, so they'd go aboard. For instance,
the fishermen themselves were or were not responsible for offloading the fish from the fish hold.
The fishermen themselves were responsible for discharging their own trip. But you have to understand that in a vessel like the Benjamin C, Joey Shermantau's grandfather's vessel, which was a highliner, and she carried about 220,000 pounds of redfish, when the Benjamin C was gone for 10 days, the gang would come in. Now, I'll tell you, I've been out fishing a few times, and when you go on 10 days, and you have 2.5 days off in between trips, when you're gone 10 days and you hit General Seafood's wharf, you want to be up the wharf and home. So what you did, you hired a lumper in your place. So the Benjamin C and every other vessel had certain boss lumpers that the skippers called and told them that...
It'd hail how much fish they thought they had.
Yeah, they would hail the trip. And also that the need for the lumpers. Well, of course, in the case of the Benjamin C, any big boat, they had two engineers, so it was always one engineer stayed aboard the boat during the discharge trip, pumps and all that business. He ran the machinery or was there in case they got in trouble. So every other trip, the first or second engineer would be aboard the boat, and the cook. The cook would be also aboard the boat because on a big trip, they'd have to feed the lumpers, and they cooked a full meal for the lumpers. And so anyway, so there were boss lumpers, and then there were underlings, or the regular lumpers that made up this core of this workforce. Now, I've always maintained that Gloucester in its heyday in the 40s and 50s, when we were landing 300, 400, 500 million pounds of fish a year, we never could have done that, regardless whether the fish were there or we caught them. We could not have accomplished that feat without the aid of the lumpers, because the fishermen could not fish for 10 days, come in and discharge their own crew, and be expected to sail a day and a half later. Impossible. And a boat such as the Benjamin C, it was considered normal to land in one calendar year between 24 and 26 trips. That was the established goal for production for the vessel. Well, to do that and to go fishing at 10 days at a time, So getting back, I remember as a boy, I talked about the Emily Brown, Captain Frank Brown. My uncle was a machinist for the Independent Machine Shop and a good friend of Captain Frank Brown's. And my uncle called me in 1944 when she was launched out of Robinson's Yard. He called me and he said, I'm going to get a tour of the new fishing vessel, Emily Brown. And Captain Frank Brown is going to meet us at the fish pier and take us on a tour. So I went down... And the Emily Brown was the closest thing to a yacht. She was finished in she was just a beautiful vessel, contrasting woods in the forecastle and the captain's quarters. The captain's cabin was like a hotel, a for a fishing vessel. It was a departure, if you will. And I can remember Captain Frank Brown, the owner of Cameron's also, Captain Frank would say, said to us, he said, well, he says, I'll tell you. He says, I remarked, I was 11 years old, I remarked to him, I says, Captain Frank, this is a very nice, beautiful boat. And he said to me, he says, well, I spend about 250 days, 275 days on this boat, and I want, if I have to spend that time at sea, I want to be in the proper quarters, and I want my crew members to enjoy a lifestyle aboard this vessel that's second to none. And he was absolutely correct. Anyway, getting back to the Hesperus Diner and Ben Pine and so forth, the waterfront populated that diner. They populated the Luffins Diner on the west end, and Luffins had a reputation all by itself. They were, Mrs. Lufkin was a caterer, and they catered turkey dinners and to all the lodges and weddings and so forth in those days. By the way, the receptions for weddings in this town in the 2020, out of town to all these venues, in the 40s, there were big weddings. They were all accommodated in Gloucester, and they were all catered by places like Lufkin's Diner.
Now, that diner, you said it was by the St. Peter's Club.
Yes.
When you walk down that little alleyway between
If you walk down that alleyway from Main Street, it would be to the right, the Lufkin's Diner. And it was, and they made the best donuts and pastries. Unbelievable. Unbelievable.
I find it, I think it's great that the diner right there you're talking about. Then we were talking earlier about the one in Fort Park and how close that is. And
but the clientele that populated the diner on Commercial Street, what was the name of it, Joey?
Was that Michelle's?
St. Pierre's Diner.
No, St. Pierre's.
St. Pierre's. The people that populated St. Pierre's Diner.
I'll bring up a photo of it.
Yeah, you have to understand that over the hill was the Cape Ann Fisheries, the first wharf I worked on when I graduated from Gloucester High School. On Sunday, when I graduated from Gloucester High School, and Mayor John J. Burke gave the commencement address, my father said to me, okay, the honeymoon's over. You have to go to work, and you have to pay your mother $20 a week room and board. That next morning at 7 o'clock, I was down at Cape Ann Fisheries on the fort, just over the hill from St. Pierre's Diner, and got my first job on the waterfront. And the first boat that was taken out there, I can remember like it was yesterday, was the Bonaventure, the Novello boat at the time. But anyway, St. Pierre's Diner was a mug-up diner. It was where all the workers, so when, and there were all a ton of workers, the Kukru Wharf, the Cape Horn Ice Company, the North Atlantic, the Progressive, General Seafoods, all these people, I can see them now walking down to the diner for a 15-minute mug-up in the morning, not so much in the afternoon, but in the morning. And of course, if you didn't bring your lunch, you went to St. Pierre's Diner. But that was the business they had. The Hesperus Diner and the Lufkin Diner, they catered to a little bit different clientele. But there were also, as I mentioned, 3,000-4,000 workers on the waterfront, and there was this core of customers that supported several diners in those days. Today, when I ride by the roast beef place where the former Hesperus Diner was, I'm saying to myself, having been in the business a little while, I said, so I don't know how this guy's making it. On the few people I see going through the door for a $12 pizza.
Yeah.
Anyway. Any other questions?
Oh, those are great stories. Those are fantastic.
Well, and then we have that diner that this whole thing started last week when McCarthy brought up the diner that's currently in Danvers. That's now probably the way we're figuring out is over in that group of stores where the
Safari, in between, yes. Safari and where the and where the laundromat is.
Right.
We figured that there was the diner, the Portside Diner in Danvers.
Was there.
Was in 1948, was there.
47, yeah.
47.
And by the way, that diner was not...
So there was two railroad car diners within a block of each other.
Yes.
The Cape Ann Diner that's in Danvers, that's an older diner. The Hesper's Diner was a torpedo shaped, like a airstream configuration. But the interesting part about the Hesper's Diner, it was owned by John J. Burke. Now, let me tell you something. If there was ever a colorful character in Gloucester, it was Johnny Burke. And I can say that for the last 100 years. Nobody was more colorful than Johnny Burke. Number one, he was a practicing attorney. He was in business with a man by the name of Sylvester Whalen, who was in the office. Johnny Burke was also an attorney, but he owned Sherman Roos Outfitting Store. He owned shares in 40 vessels that were there, and 10 of those vessels he owned outright. At 2 o'clock in the morning, he would be in Chelsea. Now, this is a lawyer. At 2 o'clock in the morning, he'd be in Chelsea picking up a load of oil for his oil tanks at the end of Chestnut Street, where the diner is, went right straight across to his wharf on Water Street, and he unloaded a tank full of oil by 5 o'clock in the morning. Then he'd go in the Sherman Roos wharf and open up for business. And at 9 o'clock, he changed into a business suit and went to his law office. And at 4 or 5 o'clock or 6 o'clock at night, if they called from the diner and said the dishwasher just quit, he'd be down in the back of his diner. He owned the Hesper's Diner, and he'd be washing dishes. Johnny Burke was not afraid of work, and he was a ball of fire, and kind of a loud, brash type guy. I can't think of too many politicians like him, but he was a colorful guy.
Couple comments. Do you remember Bernie McDonald?
No.
Lumper? Okay. Another question there was from Anthony Burnham. When you worked on the waterfront, you never had soup for supper. Why is that? Do you know that?
No.
Okay, so we'll wait. We'll wait for the answer from you, Anthony. Those are just two questions that we like to address the people when they ask questions of us. Yeah, Johnny Burke.
Yeah, Johnny Burke. He's a colorful character. Well, I'll tell you about Johnny Burke. At the time in 1947, I was on a water boat with John Winterberg, and we got our water at Burke's Wharf. It was a 3-inch pipe that come down the wharf. And we pull in the water boat. She held 5,600 gallons of water. And I was the kid. John Winterberg was 65 years old and sickly. So I was, for all intents and purposes, running the boat. And I'd hook up to Berkey's pipe, and we'd pump the boat full and so forth. So we were part of Johnny Burke's operation down there. And all of his vessels, it was a kind of an unwritten law that they would take our water. So I had a lot of business to do with the office and picking up, as the boat settled, I'd go up and get a water bill, $4. But anyway, Johnny, I was around the office all the time. There was the office manager, Mr. Fialo, and he would see to it that the water boat got paid for its water. And Johnny Burke was always around. He knew me. Johnny Burke built a beautiful home on Western Avenue. Now, I'll tell you where it is. If you come through Stage 4 Park, you go by the cupboard, you're going up on Western Avenue. If you turn left, just up the street, the Catholic Church, the Archdiocese owned a whole bunch of property. And there's this big granite wall. And if you go by there today, you can look in, and there's a set of stairs that wind up probably 150 stairs to the top of the hill where John J. Burke built this beautiful brick home in 1947. The whole fishing fleet, crew members, everybody from Johnny Burke Wharf, businessmen, all the people that were worth knowing, were invited to an open house to Johnny Burke's waterfront property. Absolutely gorgeous home, looked out over Eastern Point Breakwater. Beautiful. I was invited. And I was the only kid invited to that open house at the time. My father dropped me off at the cupboard, and I walked. Western Avenue has always been kind of narrow there, not much of a sidewalk. I walked up along the side and up those stairs and to the open house of Johnny Burke's.
Wow,
it was a great, I'll tell you right now. And by the way, in the class of 51 when we graduated, who gave the address from the city, of course, was the mayor. Well, as he was a colorful character. He wasn't too tall, kind of a portly type guy, but he's bombastic type personality, thundering voice. Well, don't you know, he hired an Italian violinist. Now, here we are, a high school class, and she's playing Ave Maria up on the stage, and Johnny compliments Johnny Burke. That was his contribution to our graduating class.
Jeez.
Anyway, what else gets it from me today?
These are great stories. People are really responding to it. Everybody loves these stories.
Can
I ask you a question? Like I noticed that some of the houses up above, if you go all the way up Hampton Hill, and you're going up the hill, then you take a left.
Yes.
There's some of those houses up
yes.
there.
There's one story about that.
I want a story about those big, beautiful mansard houses.
Okay.
So you explain lay it out for people with the views there and everything.
Yeah, it's a commanding
Mike
view.
Carter says, my first job in 1984 was working for Ron and Joan Gilson at their Union Hill Coffee House.
Who's this, Mike Carter?
Mike Carter.
Good boy.
There you go.
Yes, he's a good kid. Mike, a polite young man. I hope he's doing well.
There you go. Yeah, that's one of your fans. So tell me the story about that area.
That area...
What's the name of that street?
What's that?
What's the name of that street?
I'll
look it up.
Goes down to Hampton Hill on the backside, but right. I want to say Beacon, but it's not Beacon. It's.
I'll find it. Don't worry.
What are you overlooking, Ron? What are you seeing?
Overlooking
from the
whole harbor.
The whole harbor.
Right out.
I'll get it. So, Hovey Street?
Hovey. You're right. Okay. Well, in 1961, I came back from the United States Marine Corps, my service, and I relocated at the 95 Wheeler Street, and the best man at my wedding was a guy by the name of Edward McCollum, who became a partner in the Ocean Crest Seafoods with his brother-in-law, Tony Paco, and Eddie's father-in-law, Leo Linquata, lived on Hovey Street. He has a beautiful English two-door house on Hovey Street, and I was invited to a celebration, St. Peter's Fiesta weekend, a buffet that Leo Linquata was putting on, and he had a lot of dignitaries there. I wasn't one of them, but I was there, compliments of my best man and my friend, Eddie McCollum, who married Leo Linquata's youngest daughter, Mary Ann, and Joan and I, my wife and I, went to this buffet party type thing at Leo's house on the top of Hovey Street. Absolutely gorgeous home. I looked out over a commanding view. Well, next door, Roger Babson, the famous economist, lived in another equally lovely house. And Roger Babson was in attendance. Here I am, a young man, 31 years old. How many years ago? Well, I said to Mr. Babson, I says, well, Mr. Babson, if you have any advice, I just got out of the service. If you have any advice for a young man, you being a famous economist and so forth, I'd appreciate any kind of hints you could helping points along. Yes, he says, I'll tell you. He says, my advice to a young man would be to buy waterfront property. I says, really? Yes. He says, and I'll tell you why. There's just so much waterfront frontage. And as the years go by, that valuable waterfront property appreciates tenfold compared to anything inland. So If you get a chance to buy a piece of property and it's on the waterfront, you would jump at it. Mortgage your life, but buy that property. So that's a Roger Babson, by the way, and that was in 1961 or 62. Yes, the Hovey Street, a gorgeous properties up there. And
what would you describe the building styles? Those Victorians, a mansard? How would you describe the buildings up there?
Well, the mix. There's several different styles. Leo and Quatta's house is I call an English two-door, stucco and accented by vertical, beams, that type of thing. Brown and a cream color stucco house. Roger Babson's house was an old-fashioned,
is that a mansard?
Turn of the century.
Mansard?
No. I think it was
Victorian?
More of a colonial type colonial? Thing. But it's a mix of properties. But they're all, the thing is, they all look out on the waterfront.
On the waterfront. But a lot of fishing captains live there?
Oh, they all, that whole area was all populated by fishing captains. And the wealthy people lived in, on the corner of Centennial Commonwealth Avenue, where I lived as a baby in Alpine Court, on the right-hand corner as you go up the hill from Washington Street, that's William G. Brown's home there. Go take a look at it now. The front stairs are all torn off. The door, it's in disrepair. And
a lot of those old paintings that Hopper did.
Oh.
I mean, the houses now are shells of their former self, but you could still depict a lot of them.
Yeah.
I wanted to say, Jeff Romero said to say hi to you.
Oh, Jeff Romero. He's a good guy, Jeff. Yep.
Yep, there you go. Yeah. A producer. He's a producer.
Yeah.
So there you go. Well, thank you for that, Ron. That was fantastic.
I appreciate the opportunity to reminisce.
Yeah, we'll have to get you back. We'll have to do a list. You could do is you could put together a list of topics that you...
Well, I just told Pat... an interesting topic would be the nightclubs of the era.
Okay.
We had
how about the old? You know what is interesting to me? Another time, I want you to talk because it's too much for now. So people talk about the overrunning of the hotels and stuff like that, and what they don't realize was how much capacity this town had in its heyday with the thousands of rooms. Right. Compared to what we have now, many multiples of rooms for.
I was 17 years old, and in Donny Oakes' orchestra. Now we were all music bugs at the time. The Delphine Hotel, the Hawthorne Inn, the Long Beach Hotel. Those were the seasonal nightclubs.
The Rockaway. How about Magnolia? Magnolia.
Oh my God Almighty! I was over for Ted Weems' Dixieland Band. My God, we were drinking scotch and waters. I was 17 years old, sitting up at the bar at the Oceanside.
So we have to save this for another time. But for people that want to hear more about Ron's story, there's two things I would tell you. First of all, you can go down to the bookstore of Gloucester and get his book. It's Hardbound Back, An Island No More. Thank you, Brenda, for reminding me. An Island No More is available at the bookstore of Gloucester. It is what I consider, if you want to talk about the fishing industry at its heyday in this town, Ron speaks about it so perfectly that you smell the smells, feel the feels, and it is not a romanticized fictional. It is actually a depiction of how it really was. So it's great. So An Island No More is available at a bookstore of Gloucester. He also has his own blog, and I'll link to it in the show notes. Blog. What's the Gloucester I Love?
The Gloucester I Love Too.
The Gloucester I Love Too. So we'll link to that too.
And the latest posting to that is about the Gloucester in the 40s, and I try to capture just like I'm doing today for you. But I want to say this about 3 weeks ago I went to the senior citizen in Rose Baker establishment on Main Street, and I must admit that I amuse myself. There are a lot of good people that find the Rose Baker indispensable. They're there all the time. While I'm a member and I promote the place, I'm not always there. But I was there a while back because of once a month on Mondays, there's a jazz band that meets at 1 o'clock, and they play music, and there's about 10 musicians, and they are excellent, excellent musicians. Dave Sag, by the way, is the bass player, and he's kind of organized the whole thing, and it's a really, really a nice
event.
And this
is at the Rose Baker Center.
At the Rose Baker Center, 1 o'clock on the first Monday, the first three Mondays of any month. So starting in February, this is the last week, and we're not. Well, anyway, I have a high school friend, Bob Rudolph, and the Rudolph name is famous in the fishing industry, and that's another story, and I'm full of these stories. But anyway, I was told that Bob goes, being a musician in the high school band with me back in the 1950s, I was told he attended this dance band performance, and so I went down to sit with him. Well, I'll tell you, there's 10 musicians down there. They're all old guys like me, even younger, I would say. But anyway, the music is unbelievable. It's fantastic. And I looked around, and there wasn't anybody dancing. And I said to myself, what a great form of entertainment for old people. On the middle of the day, to come down here and dance to this beautiful music. Well, you know, like an old fire horse that hears that bell, struggles to his feet, you know, the old story. I said to myself, maybe, just maybe, I could get back into this and be in that band or play a little music. Well, a friend of mine called and said she was breaking up her house and selling her home. Her father had died, moving out of town, and wanted to know if Joan and I would come down on Saturday morning. He had a lot of books and so forth she wanted to give me. So we went down to Rockport, beautiful home. There's two or three boxes of these really lovely books on World War II and all the kind of things that I'd be interested in. And in the middle of all this, she says, well, you know, one thing I want to do, I've always wanted a golden retriever. Now, this is a woman 60 years old. And she says, I'd love to have a golden retriever. And when I move to Watertown, I'm going to buy me a golden retriever. I says, well, you know, I recently went to a jazz band event at the Senior Citizens. And I got listening to the music, and I said, gee, maybe I could get back into that business. And I've always wanted a nice set of drums. Yeah, just, you know, I don't need anything great, something secondhand. So I came home, and about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I get this email. It just said, set of drums, professional drums for sale. Well, here's the drums, they now sit in my bedroom. And
there they are. All right, I have to get going because there's a boat here. But thank you, Ron. I'm sure everybody's going to love these stories.
My pleasure.
Really appreciate it. We're going to have you back in. Thanks, lots everybody, for listening. Thanks for Ron. Thanks for Pat and Jimmy. It's Joey Shimataro, GloucesterCast 370 out. 378, we are out. Thanks again, Ron.
That was awesome.
Anyway.
Did you press?
Well done.
You do something.